Paolo Salieri, Italian-born architect, visionary, and recently theologian, sees humanity in terms of evolution, a 3-billion-year-long struggle which has resulted in consciousness. Man is not the end result of life. He is only a stage in the adventure, and he now must consciously take up the burden of making the future. Miniaturization, complexification, the process whereby each higher level of evolution rises above the preceding stage, and the process that was described by Teilhard de Chardin, is applied by Salieri to the urban environment. He arrives at the arcology, the high, three-dimensional, one-structure city that will permit man to reach higher levels of consciousness by improving the connections and accessibility of people and other elements within the city to each other. He provides a framework within which man can bridge the chasm between matter and spirit. This program is about Salieri's life and the development of his ideas. I urge listeners interested in finding out more about Salieri, Arcology, Arcosanti to have pencil and paper ready for some announcements at the end of the program. All material presented in the program was recorded at Cosanti. The sounds you hear in the background in parts of the program are those from the manufacture of metal bells. I asked Salieri about the significance of his name.
Paolo means, it stands now for revelation, the revelation that Paolo had when he fell from the horse. Salieri means where the sun, in the past tense, you were the sun.
In your youth, did you have any vision or dream of what you are today, where you are going?
Oh, I had a vision of being Tarzan. Oh, I was very busy physically. And I enjoyed it very much. The only thing was that I didn't enjoy very much socializing. So I had a number of friends, but when they started socializing, I would leave them and play around with other things. Bicycle, swimming, climbing trees, being Tarzan, things of that kind.
You never had any visions of changing civilization?
No.
What affected the reign of Mussolini have on you?
You were born in it, and in a way you cannot imagine not being with it. So it was normal, not so much in the sense that there were constant reminder that Mussolini was there, and you accept as a normal thing, but because, so what? He's there, I'm here, I'll do my thing, and there wasn't the perception that you were driven by Mussolini. The only way that I have a conscience of being driven by Mussolini is that my father was against Mussolini, so the life of my family was imprinted by my father's resistance to it. So my father left Italy to make a living in France for us.
And you stayed in Italy?
We went to France and we had to come back because he couldn't make it then, but then I went back for a season to help him in work.
What kind of work did he do?
Electrical appliances.
Paolo studied architecture at the Torino Polytechnic Institute. Jeffrey Cook, architect, critic, and friend of the Salieris, describes a project that Paolo designed at the Institute.
The most unusual aspect of the design comes with the collection of energy in these high, vertical, comb-like things that step out of the roof that were supposed to collect solar energy. The solar energy then would be transformed into some usable form. Paolo didn't really know how this would be accomplished, but he was attempting to give architectural form to solar uses. Paolo was raised, brought up, educated in a classical environment. He lived in the Italy in which the remnants of the classical world are still around, underfoot and on the sides. Paolo's thesis was a redevelopment proposal to build a university in the middle of the downtown in the oldest section of Torino. He was using the same site that Guarini had proposed to use to build a great new Baroque cathedral. Guarini's cathedral never got built. Neither did Paolo's university.
Paolo graduated with a doctorate and was awarded a small honorarium.
That gave him the encouragement to write to Frank Lloyd Wright, and Wright encouraged him to come to the United States. He told Paolo that if he would come, there would be no tuition. So Paolo, through his own efforts and his family's, a great deal of sacrifice, he got himself to the United States.
What kind of ideas did you have about America at the time?
Jack London, Zane Grey, the literature of the open. And then, it was just after the war, so you were just getting to know America, the hollow of the image, which was evidently very powerful as an image, powerful in the sense of being, in a way, the only thing you know about America. I had a vague expectation about democracy because I didn't know what democracy was, really. We just got out of the fascism. So politically, I was very, very immature or annoying or ignorant. But you were expecting, you come to America and all of a sudden, freedom. And what happened is that all of a sudden I was put in Ellis Island. So my first 35 days were in prison, America.
So it threw some cold water on your whole idea?
Yeah, because I couldn't understand why. I mean, if somebody told me why, then I could try to reason. I was 26 back then, so I could reason. But I was never told why.
Did you speak English?
No. But I think that was the main reason, because they used lawyers, not people that talked Italian. The first thing they say, do you want a lawyer? And I didn't know that lawyers were useful for anything at the time. Why should I want a lawyer? But they never told me, you are here because, up to this day, I had to guess.
You came to Arizona and to Taliesin West when Taliesin was at its peak. The old man was in his 70s, but he was hitting his stride in terms of influence and creativity, and Taliesin West was less than 10 years old, and it was in its early maturity. Paolo doesn't remember much of what he worked at while he was at Taliesin West, but he did participate in the fellowship in the way in which it was organized then and still is, and that is that your time was subdivided into three parts. A third of your time is spent learning the practicalities of living. Baking bread, doing housekeeping chores, when they were in the north, looking after the livestock, the chickens, cultivating the fields, life support, in other words. Then a second third of your time is spent actively learning construction, getting the feel of materials with your own hands, swinging a hammer, running a wheelbarrow through, full of concrete. And then the last third of your time is spent in the design studio, under the armpit of the master, working on the drawing board. So that an apprenticeship with Mr. Wright was a very balanced, very organized kind of structure.
It's difficult to pinpoint whether or not Frank Lloyd Wright. I probably was very much influenced by the fact of being there. And fundamentally, not by his presence, but the presence of him through his work, through the environment, both in Taliesin, East and West, Wisconsin and Arizona. They were both very exciting environments, in a very physical way. Physical in the sense that you felt yourself acting and being part of it and enjoying it.
Now this is one of Paolo's designs while he was at Taliesin. Paolo was invited by Elizabeth Mock, who was doing a book and an exhibition for the Museum of Modern Art on the architecture of bridges. He was an apprentice there, and she took the liberty of inviting him to do a design for this exhibition and book. And so, in 1948, Paolo designed the Beast.
Bridges are in inviting as fellows to think of them and designing them, because they give possibilities for exciting structures. And they had the advantage of being very functionally very simple. You just want to take things from one side of an obstacle to the other side of an obstacle. So it's a very elementary function that you have to deal with and cater to. So that makes for, in a way, pure solutions.
Paolo's Beast is a long, open highway of reinforced concrete in which the undulating slab flies successively over and underneath to support the roadbed. It is a completely unified proposal in which one can't separate the various parts. The columns, the beams, the arches are a complete flow in the Beast. They are absorbed and part of the totality of the whole thing.
Frank Lloyd Wright is known for his architecture in which structures blend with and into the natural. Paolo comments on this.
Theoretically, it writes that way, but then it does also different things, including the high on my needle, or the towers, or the Guggenheim Museum, or many projects that were not executed, which were not blending at all. They were very strong statements. All the buildings they did for cities, I mean. So we shouldn't stigmatize Wright with only one stigma, which stigma in a good sense, in blending or being part of the landscape, because there would be limitations of his work.
How about your own position of man making a statement in nature?
Oh, I feel more strongly than ever that nature has its own power, and we are lucky that it has this power, and man is developing a different power, or a modification of the power, and they should state it. They shouldn't be timid or cowardly about it. I think when I left Taliesin, I was working in ideas that were somehow oriented toward the blending with nature, or the idea of, you know, flowing into nature and so on. And some of that might have been left in me, but I soon changed my mind, and not necessarily consciously and in one stroke. Things have to remain what they are in fundamentally instruments for something higher. So in that sense, the idea of stewardship is right, I think. I don't think it's right when it's taken as the some kind of a total acceptance of a certain condition as the sacred God-given condition, and the rejection of the influence of the transformation of this condition by mankind, which is where I don't go with the conservationists. Many conservationists say there is something there, it's sacred, it's beautiful, it's balanced, it's perfect, we should not touch it. What just happened, that thing there wasn't existing 100,000 years ago. And many millions of years ago, not only it wasn't existing, but there was even the beginning of life in this sacred thing. So that which is sacred today is not going to be sacred tomorrow. Well, it's going to be sacred tomorrow because it's going to be altered. And we are the altering elements, fundamentally, at this point, of it. So this necessity of alteration is part of the sacredness of that condition. So to be a steward of something, it's the maintenance aspect of the relationship between me and the thing I'm taking care of. But then there is the other aspect, which is even more fundamental, what I do with that thing there, what we do together, which is the creation of the future. If I have reverence for that, I have to transform that. Otherwise, my reverence is dwindles down into indifference sooner or later.
Paolo only stayed with Taliesin for 16 or 18 months. He left in the middle of the summer with a friend by the name of Mark Mills. They left that institutional security for nothing. They had no particular program except that they were ready to leave.
Well, it was...
What were you hoping to do then?
Funny period. I didn't know. It took a long time for me to find out what the aim was. much longer than many of you people. Well, when I left Taliesin, we were camping on the wrong side of a mountain. The wrong side of a mountain because it was the north side. And we spent a winter there and it was cold. And we had a tent which was full of, we didn't use a tent. It was a storage tent, so we lived outside. But it was good to learn about the climate of the area.
After a year, the fairy godmother arrived. Her name was Mrs. Woods from Pittsburgh, who had come to Arizona with her daughter, who had just graduated from college. And these two rather delicate ladies wanted to build a house in the desert with their own hands, and they went around to the local architects. Some of them were rude, some of them were polite, but they didn't get any plans. And then they heard about these two rebels living out in the desert.
And then we built the dome house. And it was a good experience. It was more carryover of the experience, the physical experience, the manual experience that we had in Taliesin, and I had in Taliesin. So learning a little more about construction.
And the result was also that Mrs. Woods became Paolo's mother-in-law, and the daughter became Mrs. Soleri. The dome house is a kind of variation on the theme of Taliesin West. On the one hand, you get this brutally strong base of desert masonry, great boulders rolled up into a plum cake kind of masonry, and then rising out of that is this delicate tent-like shape, the dome of glass. Now the interior is really splendid because when you rise up into the dome, you're in this lovely space which has a wallpaper of real mountains that go 360 degrees around. And you sit up there and your head is above the roof, so you're looking at that marvelous, it's a beautiful desert, very rich with vegetation. And then as the sun sets, the whole interior becomes transformed and you find you're like the inside of a spider. And you get all of these multiple visions, multiple reflections. It's like being inside of a kaleidoscope. And that's the stair on the left that rises up into the dome. You'll notice these ridges back behind the stairs, which are grooves. And up at the top, there's a little fountain. The water was supposed to overflow from the fountain and run down the behind the stairs and then collect underneath the stairs and run along this way and then water these plants. It's a very pretty idea. The intent was to cool the inside by the presence of fountains and humidity. It has never worked. And then this is the floor, which is very nice. Concrete was poured, and while it was still wet, very rich designs were cut into it. And then cement color was worked into those designs, and the whole thing was smoothed over. After the floor had set up, then the floor was ground to reveal these designs and their colors, so that you have a kind of integral oriental carpet effect in the floor. This is how the dome house was originally published in the early 50s, and there weren't many post-war buildings. The building boom in the United States only gathered force in the late 50s, and this building was published very widely and gave Paolo a lot of PR. Here you can best understand how the thing was supposed to work. You can see how the thing is snuggled into the side of the hill.
Cook further stated that the building was published as an anticipation of that sensitive new architecture that was supposed to flood the country, but which never came. After building the dome house, the Soleris moved to Italy.
And here he had the opportunity to design and build a ceramics factory for a family and home industry. It was the first such factory in this town of Vietri sul Mare, and yet the making of ceramics is a traditional occupation which goes back to Roman days. Now, what Paolo did then was take the ceramics process, which is purely a lineal process, and he wound it around itself into a sort of helix.
To use, in a way, a gravity flow, a continuous gravity flow in a cycle of the making of the parts. You start with the raw material, and then, in a way, you let the raw material transform into a finished product through phases which are lower and lower in the building, so that you have a gravity flow, a continuous flow.
The building is composed of a series of pot-like shapes, and each pot-like shape is built up out of pots. The kid who threw all the pots was 16 years old when he started, and 18 years old when he finished. That was 26,000 pots later. Some of the pots are glazed and some are bisque-fired. Each pot has a kind of narrow neck, and on the inside they're plastered over so that the air space is captive and contributes to the thermal stability of the wall. So the exterior of the building is extremely expressionistic. It expresses the function of the building in two different scales.
Has the building been a success?
A great success, I think. I mean, they did very, very well. And it became quite known, and they had people getting married there and paying lots of money to get married there and so on.
The Solieris returned to the United States for personal reasons and because
the village where we were living in was flooded, was destroyed, partly destroyed. And for 8 months we couldn't get water, we couldn't get electricity, and we couldn't operate. So after 8 months of indecision, we decided we'd come back.
After several months in New Mexico, the Solieris settled on a 5-acre site in Scottsdale, a few miles from Taliesin West. The site is called Cosanti, which is Italian meaning against things, against matter, in the sense that life is in a constant battle to exude itself from matter. During the next 15 years, Solieri built workshops for making bells, studios, living space, and a swimming pool. Ivan Pintar, a longtime assistant to Solieri, describes Cosanti.
The buildings here have been built with the soil. And then the soil has been sort of built up around over the buildings and sort of terrains. It was just a flat piece of desert here, and all this play of the shapes of the walls and things were cut in and sort of played with the soil as it was dug out, dug into, to shape little areas for collecting the rainwater, and also to sort of make sheltered workspaces from the desert winds that sometimes whip up, and also to kind of funnel the winds through. Really, this area right through here makes an excellent wind trap that comes right blowing through here, sort of a testing grounds for the bells. In fact, sometimes Paolo will come out and stuff a rag up some. Some bells really are located right in an area where they ring just constantly, like a little slipstream. This is the earth house over here, and it was built right at desert level, mounted and arched up a little bit for strength. This building was built in 56, and the concrete rim there that you see at the roof line is not that thick, but it turns up to hold soil on the top. So actually you get sort of a mounding of the soil right across the roof there. I had about 4 months ago, about 5 o'clock in the morning, a horse galloped over the roof, and then the dogs chased it and galloped over the other side of the roof. So I'd like you to come in and see the house. The bathroom section is right here in the front part, which has two sinks and sort of a nice sculpted shower. The house was originally designed, Paolo had it in mind for his family, but he's never moved in here. It's sort of taken over by people like myself. For the longest time, it remained almost like a concrete sculpture before it was glazing was put in and cabinetry and the kitchen.
Many of the structures were built with a technique called silt casting, adapted by Solieri from the process he used to make ceramic bells. The process involves the shaping of silt, that is fine sand, to make a form over which concrete is poured. The work was done by students from Arizona State University who participated in summer workshops.
The soil was shaped and then the concrete was poured over it and then dug out. Now this was the first one that Paulo did. Some almost described this as doing a giant bell. And Paulo particularly likes casting concrete. There's certain integrity about a concrete building than a wood. He sort of has a certain vernacular in working with concrete. It's a personal preference, and also the materials lend itself better to the desert in this particular climate. Woods, unless there are certain kinds of woods, can very easily dry up and disintegrate. There's no drapes on this house because the patio and the walls around here form a unique enclosure that you don't isolate your house with drapes and things. You let the sun play on this house. That wall is immediately joining the shower wall on the other side. It's a very thin concrete. So after you have a nice fire in there, you take a shower in there. It's like a oriental steamy shower.
Ivan describes the kitchen living room.
You don't articulate the kitchen from the living room. And in fact, this whole kitchen area here, once you're cooking the meal, you can sit around here and convince your chef.
No way is this a subterranean piece of architecture. Both the north and the south walls are almost totally glass, so that from the interior of this thing, you're constantly in contact with the outdoors. The neighbors cannot see the earth house, and the earth house cannot see its neighbors. But from the earth house, you can see the distant horizon, you can see the mountains. You can completely enjoy an enriched desert environment. This house demonstrated how to build in the desert, how man could live here and not violate the visual totality of what the desert means. Paulo has always earned his living, his livelihood. He has raised a family and supported his enterprise through the use of his hands. Handwork, not brainwork, has been the basis of his existence. So that bells, which are the primary product of his hands, are an elementary form of his thought pattern. His sculptural way with materials is developed over many years in his handling of the clay. Of course, one has to point out that bells are in fact simply upside down pots, and one of the books that Paulo read a long time ago and is still on his bookshelf is Mumford, the City in History. And in the opening paragraphs, he talks about the city as a container. The city is a pot. And of course, Paulo's cities are containers. They are pots. There is, of course, also the great importance of Cusanti as not just a workshop of building techniques, but as a place where ideas have bore fruit. The handcraft processes, the casual, intimate, personal kind of experience on these 5 acres perhaps anticipate the richness of intimate and personal experience that one would ultimately experience in these almost megalomaniac structures of giant arcologies. Paulo put together some ideas that he'd had earlier and put together a sketchbook called The Cosmic Potentials.
Well, being in a sunny country and being very having a propensity for the outdoor made me think that the sun should be used even more than what I was using it. And naturally, when you think of the sun, then you automatically think of the wind and the water and the tides and the moon and the energy that's available. So I began to try to think what would happen if you could come up with structures shaped in such a way as to be able to capture those energies.
One of these sketches, 1950, it's a building that's shaped something like a catcher's mitt, which would face the sun. Balconies then would catch the sun's energy and transform it into something usable.